The citizens of a Dutch town near the German border made a promise some 80 years ago at the end of World War II.
Leave your boys with us. We will watch over them like our own forever. And they have done that.
Coming up, Robert Edsel introduces us to the stories of the people from Margraten and the soldiers who gave their lives to free them from more than 4 years of Nazi tyranny. In the 19th century, hundreds of Americans went to Paris to study and develop skills that would help them turn the United States into a much-admired center of innovation.
History is about more than politics and war. History is about art and music and architecture and medicine and science, all that the human mind and the human spirit can achieve.
Historian David McCullough reminds us how France has been a major influence on the New World. Stay with us for quite an inspiring hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Not all Americans went west. Coming up on today's Travel with Rick Steves, we pay tribute to the historian David McCullough. He discovered that hundreds of people who would number among America's most important inventors and scientists and thinkers and artists went out of their way to travel east to France in the 19th century. That's where they would develop skills and an outlook on life that would help make a better life back home for all Americans. Let's start the hour looking at what made America great back in the 20th century as it joined forces with our allies to help defeat the Nazi tyranny of the Second World War. We all want to be remembered. It's just human nature. In his travels and research into the stories of the servicemen and women of World War II, Robert Edsel noticed that something was missing. Beyond the courage of the Allied troops who helped to liberate Europe from Nazi tyranny, we rarely hear about the emotional war fought back home by their families. And with the distance of the years, and with the political discourse going on in our country today, it never hurts to take a fresh look at the price that was paid for our freedom. Today, the man who helped tell the stories of the Monuments Men and Women and established a foundation in their honor has another story to tell. It takes place in a small town in the far south of the Netherlands. More than 80 years later, the Dutch continue to show their gratitude for their liberators and in their promise to care for their gravesites forever. Robert has learned the stories of 12 servicemen and locals in a village near Maastricht. And he's here to tell us about them, which he profiles in his new book. It's called Remember Us. Robert, it's good to be with you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be here.
You know, first of all, we've been inspired by your visits with us over the years to talk about Monuments Men. That was, of course, the historic effort during and after World War II to save and ultimately return the art that Nazis plundered from the places they conquered. What's new on that front?
The Monuments Men and Women Foundation, which we created to honor these men and women, has continued to do amazing things. The passage of a congressional gold medal bill to award them our nation's highest civilian honor in 2014 and the awarding in 2015, convincing the United States Army to reconstitute monuments officers, a great achievement of the foundation, which took place 4 years ago. And today, after 80 years, we have monuments officers again. And of course, we continue to locate and return missing works of art. And 2 years ago, we dedicated a permanent exhibition, the first of its kind, in Monuments Men and Women Gallery at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans, where all these artifacts and the records of the Monuments Men and Women now reside.
And now you're sharing with us another dimension of World War II that is often overlooked. What inspired you to be so passionate about telling the story of 12 World War II servicemen buried in the Netherlands?
I wanted to tell their story because we need to know who some of these men and women are, and because women are very involved in this, to appreciate the cost of freedom and underscoring the fact that freedom is not free. And if you don't understand who some of the men and women are that are buried at the Netherlands American Cemetery in Margraten, this small town just 10 miles from the German border, where World War II in Western Europe started, by the way, in May 1940 when the German tanks rolled across the border, You can't appreciate this high watermark of humanity and grace that the Dutch would make a forever promise to watch over and care for the graves of the 10,000 American men and women that are buried there today.
What does that mean when they promised to take care of them?
The Dutch were so grateful to the American liberators to free them from 4 years, 4 months, and 4 days of German occupation. And they knew a lot of these American boys because they were stuck in this area. General Simpson's army was stationed in Maastricht, Margraten area from late October until March or so when the spring offensive began. And these boys from agrarian societies in the United States were familiar with this kind of countryside filled with orchards and beautiful tilled lands. And they got to know the people there, and they loved them. And when so many of the American boys didn't come back at the end of the war, even before the war was over, the Dutch were trying to figure out the answer to the question, how do you honor your liberators and thank them for freeing you when they're no longer alive to thank? So they came up with this idea of creating a grave adoption program where the locals would go out there on New Year's, Christmas, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, and the birth and death date of the soldier to place flowers. And if they had the name and address of next of kin, they would take a photograph of the grave and send it to the American family. Oh. And in September 1945, when the mail service resumed, hundreds of letters started arriving from families in the United States, and the grave adoption founders realized, you know, it's really a noble thing that we're adopting the graves of these dead soldiers, but where the real need is for us to reach across the ocean into the homes to try and assuage the grief of these families. The American Army and government wouldn't make available that information, and so one of the two key characters of the book, both women, a woman named Emily Michels van Kestnik, who was the mother of 12 children. She flew to the United States on the first plane she'd ever flown on. She landed at LaGuardia Field in June 1946, and she traveled to various places in the United States to meet with families, and to all of them she said, "Leave your boys with us. We will watch over them like our own forever." And they have done that.
You know, that is so touching. And what is remarkable to me is it endures the passing of generations. It's easy for one generation that survived the war and witnessed the war to make that promise. But now you're, in some cases, probably a couple generations later. How has that promise weathered the distance caused by the lack of living memory?
I think the Dutch have been very determined to try and keep that from happening. So they continue to take their children and grandchildren to the cemetery. They are placing flags and trying to understand more about who the men and women are that are buried there. In so many ways, the Dutch have really become more American, I think, in some extent than we are, making sure that they take care and honor this promise, and they've continued to do it. And that's why we've created the Monuments Men and Women Foundation, working with the Dutch Foundation for Adopting Graves, a joint project that we're calling the Forever Promise Project, one that we would like to help the people of the Netherlands complete by locating the names of the missing family members. And that's something that we've brought to fore in the Remember Us book, is a whole page that describes what this Remember Us Forever Promise Project is all about.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Robert Edsall, and he's reminding us of the cost of freedom, a cost that knows no national borders. And he's also reminding us how we can honor the sacrifices of the thousands who paid the ultimate price. Previously, Robert brought us the stories of the Monuments Men and the efforts to save and reclaim the art masterpieces of Europe from Nazi plunder, and that was in his book, Rescuing Da Vinci. In his latest book, Remember Us, Robert profiles the lives of American servicemen who fought the Nazi invasion during the Second World War. And in that book, he also profiles the local people who worked with those soldiers in the Dutch province of South Limburg. There's more about Robert's work at his website, and his website is simply robertedsall.com, E-D-S-E-L, robertedsall.com. Robert, tell us a little more about the American Servicemen Cemetery. I understand it was built over a muddy hellhole of a battle site, and now it's just a calm and beautiful, inspiring war memorial.
It really is. You know, each of our overseas cemeteries, and we have 12 of them that are World War II cemeteries around the world, they're each unique and beautiful in their own way. Normandy, of course, sitting there on the cliff overlooking the beaches where the boys landed. And Margraten stands unique among them with this grave adoption program, something that was organic. It unfolded not because someone had the idea for a program, but because the local people there watched over the soldiers that they knew. They walked miles. They didn't have any vehicles. They walked, they rode their bikes, some went by horse to go out there and put flowers over the graves of the boys that they knew and honor them. And it's a beautiful area. It's defined by orchards and tilled lands. You know, I've made a point of reminding Americans, we're a country of immigrants. We were, we are, we always will be. And we have in the book, the soldiers that I follow, Native American, a Black American tanker, a Black American who was charged with digging the graves, a horrific, horrific job. We have a German Jew who immigrated to the United States and then volunteered for service to be an intelligence officer. And then, of course, other Americans that are combat veterans. We really have a composition that reflects the country we were and are. And it reminds us that we pull together as Americans mm-hmm. to defeat the greatest threat to civilization mm-hmm. ever.
You know, you are such an effective historian when you bring to light intimate stories of real people. And this is kind of what this book is all about, highlighting 12 people out of 8 or 10,000 that were buried there. Tell us just one or two stories in the book that help you make the point you want to make.
A Native American, part of the Lakota in South Dakota, that has been relocated three times in the previous 40 years, in Wounded Knee in 1890, once again when the Army wanted to use it as a gunnery, and then even 2 years before he volunteered for service, and his mother pleaded with him, Jacob Herman, don't do this. America's only done things to us. They've never done anything for us. But the Native American attitude was, when the country's attacked, when the land's attacked, then we rise to the occasion to defend that land. And Jacob Herman was very proud. He became a member of the 82nd Airborne. You take someone like Robert Cole, who's born on the base at Fort Sam Houston. His father was an officer, and he had actually trained with Lieutenant Colonel Dwight Eisenhower earlier in his career, and then joins the 101st Airborne, and he's there seen again in the book on June 5th on the tarmac in England, visiting with General Eisenhower hours before he will drop out of an airplane over Normandy, a remarkably heroic man. He received the Medal of Honor for his heroism. So we really take you not only inside who these people are and what they did during the war, but we then follow them into the homes of their loved ones, the widows, the mothers, the sisters, and the fathers, trying to figure out how to survive the anxiety of not knowing, and for some, of course, grieving with no one to speak to, no information. And that's why this mission of mercy of the Maastricht mayor's wife, Emily Michels van Kesnik, she had one message, and that was, leave your boys with us. We'll watch over them like our own forever. And they've done so.
We'll remember what historian David McCullough had to tell us about the important role France has played over the years in the lives of many influential Americans. That's in just a bit. But first, there's more with Robert Edsel as we get to know how the Dutch people of South Limburg have been keeping their promise. They won't forget the sacrifices American troops made in liberating them from the Nazis in 1944. And now, neither will we. You're listening to Travel with Rick Steves. Robert M. Edsel has introduced us to the inspiring work of the Monuments Men and Women. They helped protect and recover the art masterpieces and treasures of Europe, which Nazi invaders targeted to steal and destroy. Today on Travel with Rick Steves, he's telling us the stories of American soldiers and their allies in World War II who helped liberate a small town in the far south of the Netherlands. And he's reminding us of the promise Dutch people kept to honor their sacrifice. Robert's put their stories together in his latest book called Remember Us. Robert, can you tell us how you were drawn into this by a letter written in 1945 by a Dutch woman trying to find a soldier's mother?
That part of the story is the very ending of the Monuments Men book that I wrote that George Clooney made into his film. I was trying to just wrap up the book and share with readers what happened to each person. Of course, Captain Walter Hutchausen was killed at the end of the war. And I made the note that there was a young girl, 19 years old, who lived in a town right outside Maastricht, very near the cemetery, that her family knew Captain Hutchausen, and she wrote Harvard University asking for the name and contact information of his mother so that she could share the news that she walked 5 miles each day to the cemetery to place flowers on his grave. And in fact, Harvard responded and provided that information. And that was the end of the story. In 2015, when we were helping organize the Congressional Gold Medal Ceremony, I had an RSVP from the nephew of Walter Hutchausen who said, of course I'll be there. And by the way, here's a photograph of Frida. And I thought, Frida, I don't know any Fridas. And then a few days later, I realized, you know, the only Frida I know was that 19-year-old girl that wrote Harvard in September 1945. And then I realized, oh my God, this woman's alive. So the following year, she and I became pen pals, and I said, I'm going to come visit you. And my wife said, do you have ambitions here? And I said, ambitions like what? And she said, write another book. And I said, no, this woman's probably the last woman to see Walter Hutchausen before he was killed. I feel duty-bound to talk to her. So I went to go meet with her, and she opened up these photo albums and said, do you want to see when the first tank passed by our home in September 13th, 1944? And I said, yes. And she said, are you aware of the American Military Cemetery? And I said, yes, I know about it. And she said, you know about the Grave Adoption Program? And I said, the what? And she said, the Grave Adoption Program. And I said, I feel embarrassed. I have no idea what you're talking about. And that's how it started.
Huh. You know, if we can humanize these dramatic stories, it's so easy to talk about wars in sweeping grand military terms or whatever. But the whole dimension of appreciating the horrors of war is to humanize it. You know, Robert, another way to do that is to appreciate poetry. And a lot of powerful poetry came out of the war. I know in your book that you appreciate a poem by Archibald MacLeish. Can you read, do you remember the Young Dead Soldiers Do Not Speak?
I do. MacLeish was one of he was a poet laureate and a head of the Library of Congress at one point. He was a real polymath, but he suffered losses during World War I, and he wrote this great speech about what soldiers go through and the true cost of freedom. And the poem says, the young dead soldiers do not speak. Nevertheless, they are heard in the still houses. Who has not heard them? They have a silence that speaks for them at night and when the clock counts. They say, we were young. We have died. Remember us. They say, we have done what we could, but until it is finished, it is not done. They say, we have given our lives, but until it is finished, no one can know what our lives gave. They say, our deaths are not ours. They are yours. They will mean what you make them. They say, whether our lives and our deaths were for peace and a new hope, or for nothing, we cannot say. It is you who must say this. They say, we leave you our deaths. Give them their meaning. Give them an end to the war and a true peace. Give them a victory that ends the war and a peace afterwards. Give them their meaning. We were young, they say. We have died. Remember us.
Oh, that is so touching, Robert. Thank you so much. And remember us. That is essentially what a war cemetery is all about. That poem could be the banner over the entry to every war cemetery, I would think.
It is, and it's the banner over the book. I mean, once I was aware of the poem and I understood the story, you know, figuring out the title of the book was simple. Archibald MacLeish wrote it for us.
Remember us. There you go. The people who helped liberate the Dutch from more than 4 years of Nazi occupation are no longer around to thank. But today on Travel with Rick Steves, Robert Edsel is introducing us to American servicemen and Dutch citizens who lived and died fighting for freedom in Europe in the Second World War. They're the people we meet in his latest book, Remember Us. To tell their stories, Robert's researched never-before-seen letters, diaries, and historical records. He centers his focus on Margraten, a small town in South Limburg, where many of the people he writes about are buried at the Netherlands American Cemetery and Memorial. We have links to Robert's work in this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. Now, America's military cemeteries, I've been to several all over Europe. They're powerful. They're beautifully kept. How are these maintained? What's the American Battle Monuments Commission? What is its duty? How is it funded? Tell us about that.
Well, the American Battle Monuments Commission, or ABMC, is a government appropriations. They have a group of board of governors or commissioners that are appointed by the president. They serve at the will of the president. And they're responsible for maintaining and taking care of all of our overseas military cemeteries, whether they're Spanish-American War, whether they are World War I, World War II, and so on. And the bulk of them are World War I, World War II. They do an extraordinary job, as you pointed out, whether it's Normandy, whether it's the Florence American Cemetery, the cemetery in Rome. They're all extraordinarily beautiful and fantastic settings. This is a commission that's been around. This is their 101st year. They started in 1923, 102nd year. So it's got great tradition and tremendously dedicated personnel. There's also another organization, the Defense Department's POWMIA Accounting Agency, which does the most heartwarming work that should bring tears to every American, because they continue to this day trying to find the remains of any soldier that's been lost. They use state-of-the-art DNA analysis. They are even going into graves of unknown soldiers, hoping that some shred of material there may help identify who it is, and they've had great success in that regard. So it's a tremendous amount of work.
Do you have any concern about the status of these, the funding of these organizations to keep these memories alive today?
I don't know how we could not. I'm very concerned. The ABMC, I think, will continue on, and I'm confident that the DPAA, as it's referred to, the people that do this work with identifications. But of course, when there is such severe cutting of agencies, we would be unwise to ignore the realities. And I think it's just difficult for people in Washington, in particular those that haven't visited these places or haven't spoken to the family members of veterans or our veterans, how meaningful and important these places are, and really how critical they are to our international relationships. The countries that house these cemeteries, they're really, really critical. And it's not an expense, Rick, and you know that. It's an investment, and that's what we need to bring to people's attention.
Hey, Robert, I'm curious about the issue when a family loses a loved one overseas. In the case of World War II, many families decided to have the loved ones buried there in Europe where they fell. Others wanted them brought home. What are the issues that a family deals with there, and why do so many families decide to have their loved ones stay where they fell?
That is a great question. Of course, at the end of the war, about 2 years after the war, the United States sent notices to the American families, next of kin, and gave them an opportunity to elect, do they want to leave their loved one overseas at some cemetery? They couldn't indicate which ones because they didn't know how many people would elect to leave them there or whether they wanted them brought home. About 61% of the families requested that their loved one be brought back. And that turned out to be about the same percentage as World War I, much to the surprise of General Eisenhower. He thought it would be a much higher number than 61. About 39% remained in Europe, although at the cemetery in Margraten, the number's closer to 46% because of the effort that the Dutch made to share this information with the Americans about, this is a beautiful area, you can leave your boys here. I think some families, not ever having a chance to go to Europe and no hope of doing that, just wanted, the natural knee-jerk reaction was to have them sent home. But what interested me were, why did families decide to leave them overseas? I asked that of one woman who was a war orphan. In other words, her father was overseas. She never knew her father. She was born while he was overseas. And I said, you know, why did your mother decide to leave him over there? And she said, you know, I don't know the answer to that, but I've given thanks for it every day of my life, because if she'd brought him back, I would have gone to see him at his cemetery several times, and that would have been it. Where he is now gives his life meaning. And that was so touching to me to hear that. And I think for some families, that it was an only child, it was too difficult to bear, and families thought, well, there won't be any other relatives to go visit them. So I think every family had different reasons, but I know that many families I've talked to that chose to bring their boys home, now their descendants feel like, I wish that they'd left them overseas, because We don't look at cemeteries the same way in the United States. For the most part, at least in the parts of the country that I've been, people are only at a cemetery if someone's being buried. And rarely, you know, you don't see young people at cemeteries. But when you go to Margroton, there are children, grandchildren, schools, entire classrooms out there because they drill into those kids and grandkids. You're able to be here. You're able to think what you think and say what you want to say because the men and women that are buried here gave their lives for you to have that chance.
It's a beautiful thing. And even for a simple sightseer in Europe, somebody on vacation in Europe, if you're so inclined, find out where the American cemeteries are. I've visited several, and they're always an inspiration. They exceed my expectations, and it's always been time and effort well invested for me in my travels. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Robert Edsel. His book is Remember Us, American Sacrifice, Dutch Freedom, and a Forever Promise Forged in World War II. We have links to Robert's work with this week's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio, and you can learn more about Robert's work from his website, robertedsel.com. You know, Robert, it's interesting to me that different societies honor their war dead differently. Have you given that much thought?
I do. I think that we see in the case of the Netherlands, they've created a cemetery for the German war dead. It's in Ijselstein. An extraordinary visit that I took there. There are 30,000 German soldiers buried there in the same amount of space that we have our 10,000 American soldiers at the cemetery in Margroton. It's not as well kept. It's organized, but it's a much more somber experience. The Dutch have not adopted those graves, and yet they have done a tremendous job helping get the cemetery set up and taking care of it. So there's a different kind of experience in each of these places that you go, but they're all there to tell a story. And you're absolutely right. One thing we've made easier for your listeners and for readers is in the front of Remember Us in the book, we've provided a map of all of the American Battle Monuments Commission World War I and World War II cemeteries in Europe and North Africa. And in the back of the book, we've provided a map of all the cemeteries in the Pacific. So we've made it easier for people to know that that cemetery we have in Normandy is not the only one, and neither is the one in Margroton. Almost anywhere you're traveling in Europe and the Pacific, there's something close to you. And it's one of the few things I can say with absolute confidence, you will not be disappointed to make a side trip to go to one of these cemeteries. It is an awe-inspiring experience. And of course, the one in Margroton has an element of life and hopefulness to it that to me stands above all the others.
And I got to say, as a tour guide, when I take my tours to Normandy, I also drop in on a German military cemetery because, especially at Normandy at the end of the war, these were not political Nazis that were fighting the war. These were teenagers that were dragged out of communities, whether they knew what they were fighting for or not, and sent into the front lines and just slaughtered. And when you go to Germany, it's a very poignant thing. On the Rhine River, I see in towns four-sided monuments that have blank sides still for future wars. Back in the 1800s, they just assumed wars would go forever, and they anticipated that by having the people in that little town who would die in the future save a spot for them on the memorial. And it's just the poignancy of that is just fascinating to me. And when we have a chance to go and think about what it's like to die for the good cause, freedom, and then also what it's like to die because you happen to live in a country that's ruled by a tyrant, a fascist dictator. And the Germans lost a lot of loved ones, just as precious as our loved ones, and they don't call them heroes of war. They call them victims of war and victims of tyranny. But it's a very sort of a nuanced thing, isn't it? They want to remember their loved ones, but they don't want to celebrate an evil war that they started.
Well, that's true, and I've found it particularly touching when I've been at an American cemetery, and I've had this happen at Margroton a number of times, and you see German citizens there who feel a debt of gratitude to the Americans for helping liberate Western Europe and do the things that they did. And so that, you know, it's incredibly touching when you go and you see that and the effort that they've gone through to make sure that they're recognized.
There's so many opportunities to give your sightseeing just a little more a little more impact, a little more, meaning. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Robert Edsall. His book is Remember Us, American Sacrifice, Dutch Freedom, and a Forever Promise Forged in World War II. Robert, your book is a celebration of the idea that freedom is hard-fought, and it's a vivid example of how people give their all, loved ones remember that, and even the people who were the innocent bystanders of a horrible war are wrapped up in this whole challenge to adequately remember the people who defended freedom. Can you just wrap things up for what you want the takeaway for your book, Remember Us, to be?
I want people to know how precious this freedom is and be aware that other people gave their lives for it. You know, we say this phrase, we don't leave anyone behind, but we can go further than that and make sure that we don't forget them. And that's what this story is all about, is remembering the men and women that paid for the freedom that we enjoy and making sure that we honor them by remembering them.
Amen. Thank you, Robert, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it so much.
You'll find more about Robert Edsall's work and the Forever Promise Project to adopt more gravesites at the American Cemetery in Margraten. It's on his website at robertedsall.com. One of America's favorite historians had a longtime love affair with France. Up next on Travel with Rick Steves, we remember the late, great David McCullough with a fresh listen to his visit with us some 10 years ago. He reminded us how Americans took great pains to study in France in the 19th century and how they brought home what they learned to help fashion a better society right here in the United States of America.
Rick, may I add one more sentence in Danish, because you like these tongue twisters?
Yes.
And Camilla will translate it.
Okay, great.
Rødgrød med fløde, that's a kind of fruit porridge, you would say, with strawberry. And then you have cream over. That's what we eat in summertime. Everybody eats that. And that's the word that, if you can say that correct, you accept it in the Danish society.
Danish. Yeah. So if you were, back in World War II, suspected to be a German spy, you'd ask them to say that.
Rødgrød med fløde.
Rødgrød med fløde.
Rødgrød med fløde.
Rødgrød med fløde.
Maybe it's easier to say with a mouth full of that stuff at the
Could
same
be.
Time.
When remembering the ideals that America has represented to the world, there's few who could recount the accomplishments and contributions of its most influential citizens, like historian David McCullough. It's been 10 years since we were honored to host David at our Seattle area studio. We invited him to tell us about innovative people from American history who demonstrated what greatness of character really meant. We had just finished talking about his new book about the Wright brothers, and we had a little extra time to explore what he'd learned about more of the people who helped shape our nation. From the Travel with Rick Steves archives, David McCullough tells us about the overlooked influence of 19th century France on American thinkers, artists, and scientific pioneers. They're the focus of his 2011 book called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. From the start of our nation's history, France, and Paris in particular, has played an important and unique role. It's long been a refuge and a place of inspiration for American statesmen, inventors, and artists. And what they learned from the French in Paris has then sailed with them back to the United States, injecting art, culture, and innovation into American society. David McCullough explores and celebrates how influential Americans traveled to Paris back in the 19th century and then came home to make history here in the United States. And that's all in his best-selling book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. David McCullough, thanks for being here.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Thank you.
So, David, your book talks about Americans who journeyed to Paris between 1830 and 1900. What's the premise of your book, and why this time?
Because these young Americans were going to improve themselves in their in their ambitions to do something of value in their profession. There was no opportunity for the kind of education that they knew was essential. Painters knew that there was no school of art in this country. Architects knew that there was no school of architecture in the United States of America. Medical students knew that medical training in this country was way behind that in Europe, and in France they could get the greatest medical training in the world. George Healy, one of the great classic portrait painters of the 19th century who did Abraham Lincoln's portrait and many others, he knew that if he stayed in the United States and just went struggling along as a painter, he'd never be very good. The same was true with Samuel F. B. Morse, who invented the telegraph, but he was an artist who went to Europe really to perfect himself as a painter. And it was while he was in France that he got the idea for the telegraph. And the medical students who went over came back to transform medicine in this country from what they had learned in the School of Medicine in Paris.
You know, the Atlantic Ocean was much bigger back then, wasn't
it? Yes,
it
was. In the 1830s, the steam transportation was not very much as yet. They went over by sailing ship, most of them. And they went by the hundreds. One of the most brilliant examples of it is the great sculptor Augustus St. Gaudens, who, in my view, is one of the most interesting characters I've ever written about. Admirable in the extreme, a street kid, out of the streets, literally the streets of New York, who had no opportunity to speak of until he got to France and got admitted to the École des Beaux-Arts as the first American student in sculpture ever.
If you think of an American who would be a smart kid from a good family in a great American cultural center, by the time they got to Europe, there was just nothing like it. I mean, these guys were like bumpkins.
And keep in mind, they did not speak French because Romance languages were not yet taught in our colleges and universities, with few exceptions. They might have had Greek or Latin in college if they went to college, but they didn't know how to speak French. Imagine being thrown into a hospital training school where you can't understand the language of the man giving the lectures, and you're in with hundreds of other students who are way ahead of you, and you're trying desperately to keep up, and yet they did it. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who's one of my favorites in the book, who was a great essayist and wrote Autocrat at the Breakfast Table, among other things, and he would come home to devote his life to teaching anatomy at Harvard for 30-some years. And when it came time for him to retire from Harvard, some 35 or 40 years later, and he had to give his farewell speech, he talked about the professor he'd had at the École de Médecine in Paris.
What a breath of fresh air and sort of a declaration of freedom to be able to come from America where you couldn't dissect bodies.
No.
You couldn't look at a woman's body as a doctor.
No.
And to go over there and to find out, hey, there's a whole new dimension of ability to study.
Cadavers were illegal. And because they were illegal, they were only available on the black market. And because they were only available on the black market, they were extremely expensive. So the doctors got to work with a cadaver, but students never did. So you'd have people graduating from medical school, supposedly surgeons, who'd never cut open a body in their life, doing it to a live person, and very often with little or no anesthetic.
And then in your book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, you talk about Elizabeth Blackwell.
First female doctor.
What a beautiful thing for women to have.
Oh, she was marvelous.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely marvelous. And courageous. These are all courageous
people.
Most of them had no money.
How was it that Elizabeth Blackwell, I mean, it's such a fascinating part of the book. She went over there and was actually able to come home and really bring the whole world of gynecology to the United States.
And she went for the same reason the men went, because she knew that education here was insufficient. And we, of course, were trying desperately, and these young people all knew it, to catch up.
We're paying tribute to David McCullough right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He told us how 19th century American innovators developed their skills in France in his book called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. David passed away in 2022 after a lifetime dedicated to popularizing American history and telling its stories with grace and conviction in the value of our nation's ideals. Subjects of his other works include the people who built the Brooklyn Bridge and the Panama Canal, and the early pioneers who settled the Ohio Valley. His longtime publisher, Simon & Schuster, has assembled a posthumous collection of David's essays. They'll be releasing it this September under the title History Matters. They also maintain his website at davidmccullough.com. One of the exciting things about your book, The Greater Journey, is the arduous trip that was involved in just getting there, crossing the Atlantic,
yes,
and then getting to Paris. Talk about that a bit.
Well, they came across very slowly and often not very pleasantly, and they would land at Le Havre.
So everybody really would basically land in Le Havre and then
yes.
head straight into
yes.
Paris.
Yes, and there was no train up to Paris. They would go by wagons or giant stagecoaches, they look like.
Right.
They would almost always stop at Rouen, and they would see the great cathedral of Rouen, and it just took their breath away. Now, consider, they'd never seen anything that high, that big, in a work of architecture in their lives. The tallest structure here in the United States was probably Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Not much at all.
So we're talking these Gothic cathedrals
tremendous.
Soaring to the heavens, made
yes.
out of stone.
And they'd never seen anything even remotely so old. It just took their breath away. And several of them, including James Fenimore Cooper, said if the trip across, with all its agonies, had amounted only to seeing that cathedral, it would have been worth it.
And then that was just Rouen, which is sort of a yeah. secondary side trip today for most people.
Right.
When they got to Paris,
then it was just
it must have just
breathtaking.
Well, Paris was, what, four times the size of New York City?
I would think of that at least. And, of course, it was like it always has been. It was jumping. It was life full of action.
Public spaces, arts,
yes.
Performing arts.
Fantastic food.
Fine wine.
Yes, and museums, and just walking the walk. And climbing to the tops of the hills and going into the great cathedrals.
All complemented by a sense of fashion and style that didn't exist in the States.
One of my favorite stories of all is that Augustus St. Gaudens, the brilliant sculptor, I think he was our greatest sculptor, suffered from depression, very serious depression. And he went into one of these lapses. And he came in one day to the studio and, by implication, let it be known that he was going to go destroy himself. And he went down, he was on the left bank, and he went down to the river. It was early in the morning, and went out on Pont des Arts, and he was all ready to jump off the bridge into the river. And he looked at Paris in that early morning light, looked at the view of the river, the Seine, and the architecture on both sides, and he said to himself, I don't want to die. I want to live.
Wow.
And he turned around and went back up to his studio whistling.
And 150 years later, that's the bridge that's almost falling apart now because so many lovers go there and lock their padlocks on it.
They're taking them off now.
They're taking them, thank goodness.
Because the weight was too great. Yeah.
But that's when you go to Paris so many times, you just think, you step up from the view or the table and you just say, life is good.
But the restoration of the life force, the life desire, by just being in that spot. And it wasn't as though he had never seen it before, but he'd never seen it in that light at that moment, at that time in his life. It saved his life.
You know, we've got a lot of travelers listening, David, and when you think about the joy we have in Paris today, talk a little bit about some of the sights. I understand from your book that the Louvre was open on Sunday for locals, but every day for foreigners?
Yes.
Why?
They just want people who were visiting to get the full dose in the little time they had there.
And you had the Seine River boats and can-can dancers and grand boulevards.
Oh, exactly. And just the pleasure of strolling, of seeing. That when you think about Paris, there are no great mountain ranges like you have here in the Northwest. There was no seaside view. There's a river, but it isn't a particularly distinctive river.
Right.
What you have is what human beings have built. What you have is architecture and open spaces. When Wilbur Wright got there, and he was looking at how they laid out their spaces, and he said that every important public building has open space in front of it so you can enjoy it. Why haven't we done that in New York? Why don't we do that in our city? He's learning just as those people in the 19th century learned, by the very experience of being in Paris.
David McCullough is reminding us of the important role France has played in the lives of prominent Americans, especially as the country grew up during the 19th century. We spoke with David about 10 years ago about his book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, which was released in 2011. David McCullough's many honors during his lifetime included the National Humanities Medal and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He also received the Pulitzer Prize for his books on Presidents Harry Truman and John Adams. You'll find links to his work and to his previous visits with us in the notes for this week's show.
That's at ricksteves.com/radio.
We've talked about all these impressive people, young, ambitious people. When you sort of sum up what they learned and then what they brought back to America, what do you think Americans should recognize from France? How have we benefited from France? Because there's a lot of people inclined to be threatened by, you know, French social sensibilities
yes.
and so on, and they're quick to put down the French. But I do think our countries have a very deep and powerful bond and a lot of gratitude directed in both directions. What can we be thankful for to the French today in our culture? How did these men and women you're talking about, what did they bring home and how did they change America?
Well, first of all, we should be thankful for them because we have our country. Without the French help in the Revolutionary War, we almost certainly would not have won the Revolutionary War. It wasn't just that they sent Lafayette and others over to be on our side to give military support, but they provided money. We couldn't have done it without them.
Right.
And we should never forget it. We more than doubled the size of our country with the Louisiana Purchase.
There you go.
Never forget that. But we should also be grateful to them for the way they welcomed these talented young Americans, the way they were proud to serve as part of their education, to bring them farther forward in their aspirations to achieve something of value. History is about more than politics and war. History is about art and music and architecture and medicine and science and music, all that the human mind and the human spirit can achieve in so many forms. And often it's more important than the politics and the war. Gershwin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Mark Twain, you name it. They are in many ways far more important than most generals and politicians of our past. And they're enduring. They're part of our life.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with David McCullum about the greater journey, Americans in Paris. David, we've been talking about statesmen, artists, doctors, brilliant people. There's also a lot of entertainers that just went over there. Buffalo Bill, Tom Thumb.
Absolutely, yep.
Kind of like an American stage
yes.
show.
Yes.
It's kind of a complicated mix. You've got high thinking and low thinking, basically. How did the French respond to these Americans that came over? Were they seen as bumpkins or what?
Well, they saw us as good showmen. And, of course, some of them were very important. The black musicians who went over in the 20s and 30s, the jazz musicians and the symphony, serious classical music players, and the composers. Cole Porter spent a good part of his life in France and in Paris. And, of course, he wrote some songs about all of that. That endure forever. I Love Paris by Cole Porter is one of the best things he ever wrote. And the love of art for the sake that art enlarges the experience of being alive.
These people that you write about in your book, they seem pretty serious. Did they get caught up in the fun dimension of Paris?
Oh, certainly. When they had time.
Mm-hmm.
The medical students were desperately hanging by their fingertips trying to keep up.
Right.
And most of them had no money.
Yeah, from a practical point of view, how do you go over there with traveler's checks?
No.
What do you do?
Well, I wonder how George Healy ever survived. Somehow he did.
Yeah, so they were really
the
living month to month? They didn't bring a treasure chest with them?
Oh, no, heavens no. They're living the left bank life of mm-hmm. artists, which they loved.
This must have been so much fun for you to write this book. To a certain degree, was taking on this project just a great excuse to go to Paris?
Well, yes and no, because most of the research was all here. It's the letters they wrote home.
Okay.
The diaries they brought
home.
That's
right, yeah.
Really was. My wife and I have been going to Paris since the 1960s, and we adore it, and we never tire of walking the streets and always learn something new. But I went back to walk the walk of all of these people. I went to where St. Gaudens' studio was. I went to where the medical students worked and studied, all of that. But that's part of the joy of the job. I sometimes think I take on some of these projects so I can get to go to these places.
I would imagine. So what's one of the simple joys that you and your wife would enjoy next time you go to Paris?
Well, it may sound like this is advancing age, but it really isn't. We just love to go and sit in the park.
Yeah.
And watch the people, watch the children.
It's the quintessential French
Absolutely.
Thing to do.
Absolutely. And it brings back strong reminders of how much value there is and just calming yourself in a beautiful setting and soaking it up.
And David McCullough, if you were in that park and you saw an American reading your book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, How would you hope that that book impacts that person?
I would hope that that person would want to get the most out of their time there, and they'd come back just as soon as possible.
Come back to Paris as soon as possible.
Yes.
Develop an appetite.
And bring their children.
Yeah.
Bring their friends. Share the wealth. Share the joy.
Viva la différence.
And I want to thank you, Rick, for what you do. I think your work is extremely important. You've brought joy and interest to so many of us. I'm one of your big fans. And my dear friend, keep it up.
Thank you. I think we're both lucky and blessed to have found a niche where we can do what we love.
Absolutely.
It gives us energy.
The joy is in the work, isn't it?
It is, and it connects our good readers and viewers with a beautiful world. David McCullough, thank you so much, and best wishes in all your future projects.
Thank you very much.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Casimir Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Imagine a community of well-traveled friends who love sharing tips and comparing notes. That's our online community. It's called the Rick Steves Travel Forum. You can read trip reports, reviews, and share itinerary planning questions, peruse the topics, or post your own submissions. It's at ricksteves.com, and you're invited.